Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. I'm with my food guru, Thea Lenarduzzi. Thea, hello.
But that would imply that you actually heed.
No, I don't. But I do regard you as an expert in this barren landscape of inexpertise. Anyway, we're developing what Netflix will call an original format, in which I found out your favourite food within a particular category for several weeks until I get bored of the idea. Who knows when that will happen?
Could be this very week.
I don't think it is, because we've done biscuits and crisps.
We did as well, but we did them in one episode,
We overindulged that. Only one thing for you there. Favourite breakfast. Doesn't have to be Italian, but that'd be interesting.
Well, I mean, it isn't Italian, though. It's international.
Go on.
Probably pretty international. Yeah, it's just toast and butter and marmalade. I think you can't beat
really?
That.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, it's so good.
That's your breakfast? So,
yeah.
Anywhere
in
the world.
I look forward to weekends so that I can just...
Don't you have it in the day?
No.
Why not?
I don't have time in the morning. It's too early.
Okay. What's your perfect time for breakfast?
9:30.
Oh, okay. I don't eat breakfast at all.
Yeah.
I only try and have two meals a day.
Oh, you're doing that on purpose?
I only have two meals a day, yeah.
But you would like to have three.
Yeah, I would like to just eat bread every day, every meal. But I
more or less do.
How do you manage that then? Do you just have small portions?
No, I just, I don't know. I think I was made to eat bread.
Made to eat bread. So, who was the first person to come up with poached eggs and avocado, I wonder?
Mm.
And whoever it was, I hope they managed to patent it.
They almost certainly
they
did
almost
not.
Certainly didn't.
Absolutely impossible.
Would you think less of me if I said my favourite breakfast is poached eggs and avocado on
toast?
No,
I think that's a lovely balanced...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't have it.
Coriander, lime.
Not coriander. Oh, no. Are you one of the people...
Chilli flakes.
Yeah, I take chilli flakes. Anyway, moving on. Here's the bit where I encourage you to subscribe to the TLS, where there's sometimes food stuff, but not as much as on this podcast.
We didn't talk beverage.
Oh, go on.
Coffee.
Tea? Coffee.
Yeah.
Black coffee?
Used to be. Now I put a bit of milk in it.
Are you a coffee snob?
Yes.
I have Mokkas.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you mean chocolate and
coffee?
Chocolate
and coffee.
Yeah,
I've even had coffee, chocolate and coconut milk. And do you know what that tastes like?
I don't know, but my face, if people could see it, I was just trying to work that out.
It tastes like a bounty.
Right. I don't like bounties.
Which I don't
think we're strangely soapy.
I don't feel we're very compatible.
Anyway, come on, let's sell some TLS.
Anyway, but if you like bounties, Sarah, do you like bounties? Yeah, our producer likes bounties. If you like bounties, coconut milk in a mocha. I have decaf mocha. I'm a disgrace. Oh yeah, no, why be alive? Anyway, if for some reason after all that twaddle you're interested in subscribing to the TLS, use this special offer code to get on board, the-tls.co.uk/podcast offer. It's the best price anywhere on the internet, 5 issues for £5 or $5. That's the-tls.co.uk/podcast offer. Coming up this week, what was a Roman brothel really like? Come on, we've all wondered. Well, wonder no more. Rebecca Langlands will tell us all about it. I think Thea nominated Elena Ferrante on this very podcast as one of her artists of the decade. Caroline Moorhead has reviewed her, Elena's that is, latest as yet untranslated novel and will tell us about the prospects for the next 10 years. And we'll have a poem too from Rory Waterman entitled Defences. When I was in my teens, I visited Pompeii on a school trip. Typically, I don't remember much except from listening to music in the amphitheatre, which was lovely. But I think I remember the brothel, but that might only be because it features so often in writing about the place, the dirty pictures on the walls, the seemingly tiny, comfortless cubicles. So what does the place say about the Romans and their structures around sex and power? Well, Rebecca Langlands has reviewed a book called The Brothel of Pompeii by Sarah Levin Richardson, which apparently combines erudite detective work with feminist imagination. And Rebecca is on the line now. Rebecca, hello.
Hello.
This brothel, it's become one of the iconic buildings of Pompeii, hasn't it?
It has, rather. I mean, it's certainly one of the main tourist attractions there. And I think you were just saying it features in lots of writing about Pompeii, but it seems to crop up in popular literature quite a lot as well.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? It's just because people are interested in sex?
I mean, obviously, the bottom line is that. But yeah. I think it really feels like a place that you can imagine that ancient people were in. So it has that real sense of presence and immediacy about it, I think.
What do you think people think of it? Is it regarded just as an example of a brothel and people don't think any more of it?
Well, it's interesting. You were talking about visiting there as a school child. And one of the, a few years ago, I did a piece of research actually on contemporary responses to the brothel. And lots of people have a real sense of revelation when they visit it because they feel as if it's a sort of evidence that people in the past thought about sex as well and it was okay to talk about sex. So I think people often have a very profound personal response to the brothel.
And there's pictures on the wall, so I suspect, particularly as a child, it's fairly explicit in some respects, isn't it?
Exactly, and it's not something we're used to seeing in that kind of museum heritage sort of context in our own everyday lives. So I think it has that particular thrill to people visiting now.
So go on, let's talk about this book. What's the central claim in it?
I mean, it's a very thorough study of the brothel and all the different aspects of it, not just focusing on the pictures, but all the sort of little bits of broken pottery and things that are found, that were found in the site, really trying to get a sense of how it functioned in the ancient world and what it was all about. But one of the really exciting arguments, provocative arguments, I guess, that the author makes is that it might have been a sort of one-off failed business venture that's actually unlike anything else in the ancient world. So we think of it as this representative brothel that shows us an insight into the lives of the ancients, but actually maybe it was something a bit strange and odd for them as well.
And what's the basis for that theory?
Well, one basis is it appears that the cost of sex in the brothel was extremely cheap. And the brothel appears to have been catering for very low-class Roman men, even slaves, who didn't have much money. And yet, her, as you called it, detective work that she's done shows that what was on offer was something actually, well, quite luxurious in its own way, and also very, very much trying to conjure up a sense of luxury in the brothel itself.
So it's a bit like a gentleman's club but made available to the poorest in society.
Yeah, I mean, almost not a gentleman's club, but I guess pretending to be a gentleman's club, something like that. So it's sort of trying to conjure up what it might feel like to be a gentleman for people who really didn't have the life of a gentleman at all.
So, I mean, if it was a failed business plan, that sort of suggests that it can't have lasted very long because it would have surely become quite evident quite quickly that this wasn't going to work financially.
I guess so. I mean, obviously, that is a sort of a speculative argument that she makes. And one of our problems is obviously it's very difficult to date things in Pompeii. There was the destruction of the city kind of preserved things in a particular year, but it's not clear how long things were in operation beforehand. But yes, I think her argument would be that it sort of somebody sunk their life savings into it and then it didn't work out.
And what sort of... The pictures are all of straight sex, aren't they?
Yes, I mean, straight in the sense of heterosexual, but also straight in the sense of very much straight vanilla sex, nothing kinky, nothing a bit different, which is different from other kinds of painting that you find in Pompeii.
Oh, so tell us through that. So there are pictures of kinky stuff, but not in the brothel.
Yes, exactly. There's another set of paintings, very well-known paintings in the suburban baths, which show fellatio, group sex, cunnilingus, all sorts of girl-on-girl action and various other kinds of sex acts. And they're very different from the ones you find in the brothel, which are all a man and a woman having vaginal sex, basically.
And what's the theory that follows from that? That's what you got there, or that's what they want to advertise? Because there's some graffiti that suggests sort of oral and anal sex as well. But is the theory that this was a place where you got vanilla sex?
Yeah, I mean, her theory is that not so much that only vanilla sex took place there, but that the sort of heteronormativity of it was important. So the idea that the paintings represent sex of between a beautiful man and a beautiful woman is part of the sort of fantasy that's being sold by the brothel. I mean, there are other theories about the suburban bath paintings and why they represent all sorts of other different kinds of sex acts that complicate the argument a bit. But yeah, so her argument is other things may have gone on there, but they're trying to sell a very straight, heteronormative experience.
It's a really interesting idea, though, isn't it? Because if it was a failed business project and and it was pushing this very, as you say, heteronormative idea of Roman masculinity for poorer members of society. It sort of, you wonder why and whether, I mean, whose idea was this? Because if it was the people who were starting the business, as I said, they would have run out of steam quite quickly. So then you sort of start to think, I wonder if it was subsidised on some level by the local government or something.
What, as a way of keeping lower slaves
and
lower class people happy?
Yeah, to stop them from rebelling and to keep them happy, and also to propagate a kind of healthy, in inverted commas, idea of masculinity and sex.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, it's so difficult to get your head around what would have gone on and why these things were set up in this way. But it's, yeah, I suppose it is possible that it was something that was, I mean, if not state, it could even just be the wealthier people wanting to keep people happy and keep them.
What follows for the life of the sex workers themselves? Because there's an argument here, well, this is you're a slave or you're a very poor man in Rome and you want to pretend you're not. So you go to a place that offers you a nice glass of wine and sex, and you get to feel like a great hero. What does that mean for the people who are providing the service?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, and that's one of the really nice things about the book, actually, that it really goes into that and thinks about, it has almost half the book is trying to reconstruct the experiences of prostitutes, whether they were male or female prostitutes who worked in the brothel and what their lives would have been like, and exactly sort of sense that if you're the person that's kind of catering, you know, trying to make someone else feel good and cater to their comforts, then you're obviously expending a lot of your own emotional labour on them as well. So it seems like it would be hard work for the people working there.
And what was her conclusion then? Was this a bleak place for them? Would these have been slaves themselves?
Almost certainly slaves, and I mean, to a large extent, she's looking at comparative material from other cultures as well. But the sort of, you know, obviously there's a lot of room for exploitation in any prostitution establishment. But I think, I mean, there's a certain amount of bleakness to it, there's no doubt. But also there's a lot of humour as well, because there seems to be, you know, this companionship, and there's also all the scribblings on the walls of sort of jokes and adverts and things lend a bit more of a liveliness to it. So you do get a sense of, you know, comradeship and humour going on in there as well.
There's also the suggestion that the women who were working in prostitution weren't probably as marginalised as they would tend to be today. You describe, for instance, how the residences are kind of
pell-mell
right. With the brothel.
Yes, that's another really nice thing that she does, thinking about the upper floor of the brothel and the way that was probably apartments that were separated, but people would be mingling and socially. Yeah, that's right, exactly. And she talks about them going to the well. They'd have to go and get the water from the nearby well, so they'd all sort of go to the cafe and sit and gossip while they were getting the water from the well. So, yeah, there's a sense of the integration into the wider community that I really liked from her book as well.
Do you know what I found extraordinary, Rebecca? And this is my own ignorance, but you say that this is the only purpose-built brothel in the archaeological record that's ever been identified.
Yeah.
And yet, if I read sort of historical fiction, a lot of which is set in Roman times, the concept of a brothel and sort of soldiers on leave repairing to the brothel to drink vinegary wine and have sex with courtesans is such a cliche of the sort of modern classical imagination. Are there really not lots of archaeological ruins of brothels dotted around the Roman world?
Well, this is one of the big questions, anxieties of the scholarship, because there's nowhere else that has all the different elements that this building has. So it has the cubicles with the beds built in and the pillows on them, and the erotic paintings and the graffiti. All of those things come together, and it seems absolutely incontrovertible that this is a brothel. But clearly, brothels do not have to have all of that paraphernalia, and any building could have served as a brothel. So I think, you know, that we don't need to give up that fantasy if we find it appealing that
it's a surprise, though, isn't it? I mean, bearing in mind there's a lot of Roman ruins about the place, we've invested culturally for hundreds of years in reconstructing that. It's just struck me as astonishing in a way that the only place that, as you say, has all of those factors in it is in Pompeii. But maybe they don't last for obvious reasons, maybe.
Well, that is another thing, exactly. So some, obviously lots of buildings, I mean, there are buildings which could be brothels and people want them, you know, want to think that they might be. And the baths that I was talking about, some people think, oh, maybe some of the rooms in the building were used for prostitution. Yeah. But it's, yeah, that particular, I mean, obviously stone is durable and other fabrics and wood and other kinds of building materials aren't, and paintings get painted over. And so things don't last. And that's one of the problems that we always have. Yeah.
I just been interested in in ancient Rome, do we know the relationship to prostitutes and sex work generally? Is this integration that you talk about, is that a kind of common thing in the literature, that someone who's a courtesan, or maybe there's a difference between a courtesan and a prostitute, was prostitution regarded in a different way to how it may say be today?
I mean, that's a complicated question. And again, it's another one that scholars argue over, because there are some arguments about whether they had zoning and red light districts in antiquity in the same way that we do today, or whether brothels were just haphazardly throughout the city. And there's not an agreement on that. Brothels are mentioned a lot in the literature. People pop into brothels and they're seen as, in fact, there's a whole genre of literature, ancient Roman comedy, which is very, very popular. Theatre where prostitutes are usually sort of stereotypical main characters, and they often have a brothel on stage.
Oh, is that sort of Plautus and Terence
exactly,
type stuff?
Plautus and Terence, exactly. So that was really kind of popular stuff. So they're very much part of the community. You know, they're integrated into popular imagination in that way, certainly.
But with a certain whimsical, or it seems to me that you wouldn't have many these days. Broad comedies featuring sex workers. There's possibly an argument that if Plautus and Terence could say, oh, there's so-and-so, the courtesan, that they are not regarded quite as distinct or as quite as shaming as some people regard prostitutes today. It feels like it might have been more seen as part of the sort of normal circulation of the city.
Well, I think there's... On the one hand, I think that could easily be the case, that there's more of an expectation that you might, you know, rub shoulders with people. But on the other hand, Rome was a very, very hierarchical society. So one of the things about prostitutes is they didn't have the same legal rights and status as people who are non-prostitutes. So if you were registered as a prostitute, you lost certain civic rights.
Yeah. Well, maybe a society that has slavery kind of has already gone past that point. So within the context of a slave society, they weren't particularly disregarded. But it's a slave society, so all sorts of human rights have already been thrown out the window.
Yeah, so there are gradations. So you can be free, you can be a free person, you're not a slave, but at the same time, you are not, you know, you lose some of your status and rights by practicing prostitution. So and in some times, so for example, under the Emperor Augustus, he wanted prostitutes to wear clothing that would mark them out from other women, so that it was very clear when you walked down the street who was and who wasn't a prostitute. Oh. So who you could accost and who you couldn't.
Do we know what that clothing was? What it was?
Yeah,
like?
they wore togas, like men did.
Oh.
And the women, the respectable women would wear her nice long.
That's an interesting thing to unpack. So to be a heterosexual sex worker, you dress like a man is a kind of interesting idea.
Yes, I mean, not an everyday man, but I don't know enough about it and whether it's exactly the same toga as men did, but it's certainly called that. And yeah, it is very interesting.
And how long did it last? I mean, did it not survive Augustus?
I don't know.
Well, look, we're dragging you out for the areas that you're not your expertise. Isn't this an interesting subject, though? Because although it's at one level quite a small subject, it does speak to... We all have views, don't we, about the Roman world. Because, I mean, Thea's Italian, so you'll have probably different experience of schooling. But, you know, I grew up doing Latin. And so I read historical fiction. So I feel I have this sort of semi-caricatured view of the bustling... You know, Chandler-esque city before the time, and then we're confronted. Well, how true is all of that?
Yeah, I mean that city that you're describing is exactly what Juvenal conjures up in his satires, and so it comes straight from the ancient literature itself. It's not something that we've just invented, but obviously our imagination then tweaks it as we wish.
What about in Italy? What do they do with the Roman inheritance?
Well, I mean, it's very much there, and obviously it's been brought back for various political reasons repeatedly.
Yeah.
I don't really remember how we were taught it at school, and also remember I didn't go to an Italian school. I went to a weird European school.
Yeah. Do they do a lot of Latin in Italy?
In school?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, you sort of decide which school you want to go to, but whether you want to go to a linguistic or a technical or whatever. But yes, I mean, yeah, I didn't do Latin.
You didn't
it was optional, and I didn't
come on,
do it.
Thea.
I know.
Oh, dear.
I know.
Rebecca, you sad that Thea didn't do Latin.
I know. It's very shocking.
Yeah. Just finally, Rebecca, this seems like a really... You seem that you like this book, and you learnt a lot to it. You would have read it a while ago. What's kind of stayed with you?
I'm actually alluding to it just now, but that sort of sense of the lives of the people who were in the brothel, the way that she managed to really nicely evoke, it's a very scholarly work, and it's very, very much based on the evidence, but she really makes the evidence sing. She makes it, you know, sing to us about what the ancient world would have been like. And I liked that sort of conjuring up of a world that we don't always think of when we think of antiquity.
Yeah, I love that as well. Rebecca Langley, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
It sounds fascinating.
Yeah,
isn't it?
And it's so interesting. I just cannot believe that there's not. Do you not think that's weird that there's no other purpose-built brothel?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure it's true. I was trying so hard to think of all the other Roman ruins that I've been to. You know, Ercolano, which is just up the road from Pompeii.
Yeah. Herculaneum.
And yes, exactly that one.
Yeah.
But then when you say it, I suppose it is partly because, as Rebecca says, the erotic art is scattered around all over the place, so it sort of takes the division out of the thing, so you don't only think of the brothel as being this one specific location. It sort of disperses.
But this idea that you could... I also think it's the idea of you go into a... You can see the bedroom, and you can see the painting on the wall that looks a bit like a menu.
Yeah, and you can see it long before it comes, because there's the longest queue you've ever seen.
I don't remember...
for that one building.
I wish I could remember. I was 15 when I went on a school trip, and my interests were slightly elsewhere, mainly watching the girls I was with be accosted by Italian men.
Oh.
Italian men, man, that's maybe a subject for another podcast, Thea. But my eyes were opened, and not in a positive way. But I won't hold you responsible for.
That's a relief.
Yeah, exactly.
Elena Ferrante is a regular on this podcast, in topic, if not in person, and it's not, as Stig might have you believe, all my doing. The final instalment of Ferrante's much-loved Neapolitan Quartet in 2014 was followed by a highly publicised and highly criticised investigative article that claimed to reveal the pseudonymous author's identity as the translator Anita Raja. After the article came the angst. Ferrante had always maintained that anonymity was absolutely essential to her project. I have gained a space of my own, a space that is free, she said. To relinquish it would be very painful. And so we waited. Could she write again? Yes, cue mass relief is the answer. A new novel has, as you may have heard, arrived, and I'm pretty sure the TLS is the only Anglophone publication to have a review of it, because it won't appear in translation until June. Caroline Moorhead, the author of that review, joins us on the line now to tell us what we have to look forward to. Hello, Caroline.
Hello.
So, La vita bugiarda degli adulti, The Lying Life of Adults, is the book's title. Can you give us a brief outline of it?
Yes, it's not totally unlike the beginning of the quartet, in that it really is about a young girl, in this case an early teenager, and her two friends. The difference here is that the girls come from the middle classes rather than the poor areas of Naples, of her original heroine. And this girl, who is much cosseted, an only child, much loved by her parents, discovers one day that her father doesn't love and admire as she thought. She overhears him saying to her mother that she's very ugly and nasty. And these are the terms, just like his sister, with whom he has totally fallen out. Now, she had grown up with the name of the sister, which is Vittoria, as a sort of synonym for all that was most horrible and hateful. And so what she does is she decides to go off and find this aunt, in fact. And this aunt belongs to the poor area of Naples. So there is this contrast between the rich Naples and the poor Naples. And Vittoria turns out to be fascinating and rude and violent and altogether a mile away from the refined world in which she grew up. At much the same time, she discovers that her father is having an affair with the mother of her two best friends. And this precipitates the girl into, if you like, into growing up and not being a good little girl anymore. She sleeps with a boy, she wears hideous clothes, and above all, she does very, very badly at school. So what the book really is about, it's about this moment of transition between childhood and adulthood, if you like, which has always been wonderful Ferrante territory.
So that's all precipitated by an early betrayal. This is all very familiar territory to Ferrante readers. There's the kind of the search to get to know the past, and the past is usually a kind of an underworld.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. She is a master at providing detail from the past that fits into the present. I mean, what she is incredibly skilled at is this sort of tapestry. You feel it's almost like sewing a piece, and she fits in little bits and she colours them differently and then she weaves in something else. It's like a whole woven tapestry, her canvas. This is where, in a way, it's like the other books. But it's also, I think, it's very enjoyable reading. It's enjoyable and quite sort of troubling reading.
Does it feel new, or does it feel... not like you've read it before necessarily, but do you feel like she's pushing things further? Because truth, the striving for it, is this idea that comes up again and again in relation to Ferrante's work and her identity, sure, but, you know, also in Ferrante's own discussion of her work, she's looking for this truth. Is there a new truth, or a truth kind of framed differently?
Oh, that's difficult to answer. I mean, many of all her old concerns are there. The concerns, you know, relationships between mothers and daughters, adolescence, the way things are never what they seem to be. I think if there's a new thing, it's in the title, the lies that grown-ups tell. This really is a book about the betrayals, conscious and unconscious, that come with not facing up to the truth and not wanting to tell the truth, and the sort of alternative realities that you can spin like a web out of the world. Now, that's slightly different from the rest, but anybody who loves the quartet will enjoy this because, yes, it's much the same territory, but it feels new.
Will it therefore be in the... I'm interested about that. Will it be therefore be in the shadow of the Neapolitan Quartet, because that already exists, that's kind of achieved canonical status? And if you're broadly in the same territory, but it's not the quartet itself, do you think this will be regarded, therefore, as a good but minor work in comparison with the major work for which she's most famous?
Well, that's always going to be a trouble, I think, because that quartet assumed such sort of iconic status. Certainly in Italy, the reviews have been very good, and not too much has been made about its similarity to the quartet. I mean, people have admired the novel for what it is. Will it go down as a minor? I don't know. I found it extremely enjoyable and unputtable down.
It's a modern setting, isn't it? Because, I mean, there's something very 20th century, arguably 19th century, I suppose, about Ferrante and the world that she has kind of brought to us. I almost can't or don't want to imagine her with... you know, in the world of smartphones, for example. But this is a modern setting, isn't it? Giovanna's coming of age in the 21st century.
Indeed it is. And indeed, phones do make their appearance. It is the 20th century. But equally, you're quite right. It doesn't in any way feel sort of a reflection of the sort of malaise of modern times, a sort of obsession, if you like, with social media and that just isn't there. In a sense, it's sort of timelessly around the turn of the century, isn't it? It's to do with growing up in that Italy, which came after the end of the sort of good financial times, when everybody was slightly anxious about work. But before the sort of difficulties of the modern politics and so on in Italy. Actually, it's quite divorced from politics, which actually I think is also true of quite a lot of her novels. You don't feel that she wants really to be plugged into the travails of modern political Italy.
But that's quite a trick to pull off, isn't it? Because if you're setting it in the modern world and you cut it off from politics and you don't clutter it up, you know, your heroes aren't stopping to update their Facebook page every 25 minutes or tweet. Yeah. It's quite a hard trick because in some ways that is the modern world, and she is a great realist, and she's a great, places you very much in the physical world where she's describing Naples in all her books. Presumably this one too is evocatively described as a real place. Is it hard then to play the trick of not cluttering it up with all the bits of modernity that do also exist?
Well, it certainly didn't bother me.
It sounds great, but it's hard to do, I'd have thought.
Yes, but I think so much of her concerns are to do with what goes on in the head. I mean, I think where she is most brilliant is in imagining herself into the heads of her heroes and heroines, really, basically heroines, really. She comes more in the school of people who really write about endlessly about what is going on in their heads. And I make that sound less good. I think in a way it's very good because she does it brilliantly. But I think that's where her real interests lie.
She said, really, and she said this almost in terms, that an anonymity kind of enabled her to do that. If you don't fetishize the author, she can inhabit other people's heads in that way. The post world in which she was identified, and that identification has never really been confirmed either. Some people still don't think it's right. Has that changed anything, do you think, to her in the way she's written about, or rather the way she writes and in the way that she's read and written about?
Well, amazingly enough, I think not. I think that I was surprised at the degree of outrage there was when she was, as it were, outed. I was very, very surprised. It was the New York Review of Books, wasn't it?
And it was
much
criticised
for the piece.
Well, they took it from Il Sole 24 Ore, and a German newspaper published it as well.
Yes, absolutely. But I suppose what I must have picked up on is the sort of English language.
Exactly, yeah. They that's where it really took off, because, I mean, how many people read Il Sole?
Exactly, and everybody's saying, you know, this is completely intolerable. I think that the strength of that reaction was what it made it possible for her to, as it were, move back behind her wall of silence and pretend it had never happened. I mean, I think her book, Frantumalia, is really, really interesting because it says much more about her than I've ever seen anywhere else. And a lot of these are interviews that she conducted via her publisher, with queries put to her by some interviewer, and she anonymously, if you like, answered them. And anybody really interested in her would be fascinated by that.
Mm. What's interesting with that book is that exists, Frantumalia, as you say, but she's not, her books, her novels aren't sort of tricksy in any way. They're not really preoccupied with writerliness or being a writer or her own identity. She seems, one of her great strengths, it seems to me, is she's a proper storyteller. She doesn't get caught into that sort of postmodern approach to writing.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I'm sure you know that there was always quite a lot of criticism in Italy that she wasn't a more stylish writer, if you like.
Oh, stylish in the sense
of course. There was a coarseness to her writing, a kind of
exactly.
Unpolishedness.
Unpolishedness, exactly.
What, in the prose itself?
In the prose itself. That's always been a criticism of her in Italy. But that's slightly to do with the sort of belles-lettres, the sort of sometimes mannered approach of a lot of modern Italian writers. I mean, I find her really enjoyable for that reason.
Can you see what they're talking about when they say coarse?
Plain is what I would say.
That's good, though, isn't it?
Well, for me, it's excellent.
It's about the tradition, though, isn't it? As Caroline's saying, you're saying sort of within the context of the great history of Italian letters, it's almost like Hemingway's just happened.
Exactly.
Really?
She's not a sort of stylist, as people, you know, maintain they long for. I mean, I think what would be really interesting is what comes next. Because in a way, I think it was perfectly okay to go back and write another book about young girls growing up in Naples. But I think in a way she has to now branch out.
Mm.
I know she wrote her earlier novels were not exactly about this, but I think what would be wonderful now would be if she turned to some other area of people. I don't really see her writing something which isn't about being in people's heads, but another discourse, another narrative, if you like.
And maybe another city. I mean, because it feels like she's done Naples, hasn't she?
She really has done Naples and maybe another city.
And exactly. Yet she seems to be concentrating more, because her previous novels tend to have split yes. events or had sort of character revelations come in different cities, northern cities, to kind of heighten this contrast, whereas, you know, between the northern way and the southern way, whatever those things mean. Whereas here, everything's happened in Naples, and the contrast between the rich and the poor, the you know, the vulgar and the refined, the superego and the id, I suppose, all is brought to bear in Naples itself.
Yes, and somewhere in Frantumalia, she says something about, you know, everything I do, everything I think about, in the end, always goes back to Naples.
Mm.
I read about that. There's an argument she's a classicist in some respects, and she talks about Carthage as this sort of city with real stones that was kind of part of the imagination. And then Naples is effectively the same thing. It's a place where the stones have character, the stones have a sort of valency that she wants to sort of bring to bear in the writing.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And I think, again, if you read Frantumalia, you discover to what extent she's highly educated and cultured. She has references to everything you can possibly think of in philosophy, and she's very interested in analysis. And she's a great reader, and she's read very, very widely. And in a way, you don't necessarily get that from the novels.
Because it's not show-offy. She's not a show-off. Should I be faintly disappointed, Caroline? Because it strikes me that it's why I'm sort of trying to get to the idea of it, how minor it is. Maybe that's the wrong way of putting it, but maybe the next thing has to be a bit different. Because if you've done this sort of timeless quartet, you know, we were talking about at the end of last year, is if you looked back at the last decade, she was arguably one of the great writers of that decade doing this stuff. The next book comes out and it's a bit, well, you know, young girls learning about themselves and adulthood in Naples.
You can't keep doing it. No, I agree with you. I don't think, well, to my mind, it would be good if she didn't do it again now. I mean, it would be good if she moved away and found something. You see, what I don't know from her identity or what is, what sort of age she is.
No,
that's interesting.
I read it as sort of middle-aged woman, because there was an argument about whether it was her husband or her,
I mean,
wasn't
it was there?
Her,
yeah.
And all that stuff. So it felt like she was, and she'd had a professional career.
Yeah.
Connected to classics or connected to publishing. So it felt to me, reading that stuff. Although the other thing that's interesting is I almost entirely forgot who she was, because A, I didn't particularly like the way it was done, and B, it wasn't that important
or
memorable. And it's just kind of, to me, it's slightly fallen away. I was actually looking before, I was Googling around, and there's no great, even now. Yes. It's almost as if in a courteous way, the literary world has sort of said, well, let's forget that terribly common journalist dared to do this, and everyone's sort of not talking about it.
No, and I think that's very interesting and also very impressive.
Mm.
And I, you know, I think when she says, I didn't want to come out from behind the wall because I'm not interested in the world of modern celebrity, I think she for herself was absolutely right. She wasn't being falsely modest. I think she just genuinely wants to remain solitary.
And yet the cynic in me, Caroline, which is quite a large part of me, thinks that if you were to be playing the game of celebrity, one great way of doing it is to create mystery around yourself by never being identified.
Yes, but I don't go along with your cynicism here.
Right.
I don't think how do I know?
Yeah.
I just don't feel that so.
Well, no, but you've read a lot of her in the language she writes, and I think you get a sense of an author there, because you can argue that she slightly had her cake and eaten it. Because she is, no one really knows who she is, even now, and yet the brand Ferrante is in some way enhanced by her anonymity.
Yes, you can, but I resist the notion it's conscious. But I may be wrong, I may be totally wrong.
What's the point in having cake if you're not going to eat it? Why shouldn't she eat it?
Everything always comes back to eating with you, Pia, doesn't it? That's classic Italian. It always comes back to eating food.
Well, I'm sure she'll get lots of cake this time.
Yeah, I'm sure she'll never be short of cake now with what's gone on over the last decade. Caroline, what a great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye, Caroline.
Thank you, Thea. Bye.
Well, I'm not going to lie. I don't think anyone would be fooled. I am going to read this.
In Italian?
Yeah, well, I need to get hold of it first, but yes.
Yeah. Would you read it in Italian and English? Once you've read it in Italian, I don't need to bother.
Well, what I've done with the previous ones is the first few I read in Italian. I don't think they were available in English. I can't remember when they would have been translated. But then the Neapolitan Quartet I read in English because that's what was here, what was available. Yeah. And then I read the Italian of one of them to just to sort of see how it worked.
Yeah.
Out of interest, really.
Has she been well translated?
For the most part, yes. I think there's always stuff that you can quibble with. But now I will... Yes, this is only available in Italian, so there's absolutely no choice and I wouldn't.
I'm slightly in awe of that. You know, I love the idea of being able to read a complicated novel in two languages. I think it's
Latin? Possible. You probably could.
I could read a bit of it. I'd give up. I could read a chunk of it in Latin. Oh, we didn't mention, but she's now sort of elevated into the pantheon, isn't she, for Anthony? Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Oh, she's making a film of The Lost Daughter.
Yeah, my favourite ever interviewee, Maggie
Gyllenhaal. She is great.
And you're so glad, because imagine if she wasn't. And she came into I was at the Radio 4, and we came into the interview, and I thought, I'd just done an interview with a director who I won't name, who had been very... arms folded, why are you asking me questions? I'm like, well, why are you? I don't want to talk to you either about this. But and she came in and she was so clever, Maggie Gyllenhaal. And you asked her a question, she paused and then had an answer. But she was really into Ferrante. She was really important to her. Whether that film will...
It will be very interesting to see. It's possibly one of the kind of bleakest of the novels.
Yeah. But does she need elevating further, Ferrante? Do you think she's now...
I think she's stratospheric.
Really? Yeah, and you're going to find out, and you can tell, when will you read this?
I feel that I have a period of sitting
oh, you do?
Coming up, so I think I'll just...
Can I be honest, Thea? I feel that we set each other these slight reading challenges, and I'm not sure they're ever
done. Have you read that nine-volume space opera?
No, I've read the first one.
Really?
Yeah, I did.
You?
Yeah. Lucy came in the next day, and I read it, and she gave it to me. It's called Leviathan Wakes, the Expanse, and I read it. It was like 500 pages. I quite liked it. I don't know. I think Lucy's a bit disappointed because I said to her, it's pretty good. I enjoyed it. It was a bit sort of detective-y. I just, in the end, my heart doesn't beat faster when, you know, people come out of airlocks and have to deal with intergalactic space travel. I'm not sneery of it. It just, it doesn't do it for me. But I did do it. So what I'm saying is... You're going to have to do this.
Yeah.
Is there something else you're supposed to read?
Well, I will happily, very happily read this, also because I've chosen to do it myself. Where I struggle is when people thrust books upon me, especially if they come highly recommended, because I sort of...
But also, you don't want to be too belated to anything, do you?
Yeah.
Yeah, quite right. It's time for a bit of poetry. This week in the paper, Rory Waterman has published Defences, which takes us from Kirby Muxloe Castle to Belfast Zoo. Rory is going to read it for us. Rory, over to you.
Defences, Kirby Muxloe Castle. Crikey, you say. It's gorgeous. Across the moat, two hunks of unfinished battlement reflect, a bit like the butterfly prints we once did at school, the bottom halves faint and blemished. Let's walk it round, and never mind the scuppered portally breaching by the bridge that was a drawbridge. The teams of mallards sifting wavelets don't. Then, when you see a moorhen padding the roots of an undercut willow, instinctive bird-brained head quantum leaping about on the stem of her neck, 10 balls of chick bunching and stretching behind as she pushes away to the safety of open water, you act as I once would have. Look, she's got 10! At Belfast Zoo, between goes on the toddler swing, I finger jabbed at a peacock stretching its fan. Duck! But I was one and can't remember this tale, which might be true. And 10 years later, a young ornithologist tied to the heart of his father, keen to impress somehow as we boated the broads long bends of Reedford River, blue-green-blue, I pointed out a preening crested grebe riding the ripples. He was half blind by then, a sudden genetic inconvenience, and couldn't see it and said he thought he could. A windmill stretched its X across the sky. geese beat frantic along the water runway. He turned his head to show me I could show him. And that night, when we'd moored beside the Swan, and after my bedtime, as I raced model hawks surreptitiously around my cabin, he punched his would-have-been wife in the eye, then went back to his scotch. I watched them through the crack he couldn't discern along the door jam, and knew the truth, then how to doubt the truth when he said, then when she said, that she'd slipped. The bitterness of justice, never done. Dandelions are stitched down to the water where ramsons have flowered. I pick one and we taste. You bunch your nose to wrinkles. Do you mean it? Then pounce for another bite. Leave me behind this blackthorn hedge. No, let me drive us home.
That was Rory Waterman reading Defences, and his second collection of poems, Sarajevo Roses, was shortlisted for the 2019 Ledbury Forte Prize. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Rebecca Langlands, Rory Waterman and Caroline Moorhead. Do subscribe to the paper this week. We've got lots of great stuff, including an introduction to the life of the greatest diplomat of the 19th century. Do you know who that is, Thea?
Sorry, I completely zoned out there.
Okay, who is, according to the TLS, the greatest diplomat of the 19th century?
Oh, it's, what's his name? Metternich.
Yes! Hurrah!
I was miles away.
That's good, though. I'm going to do a little quiz. We'll also talk about that, A History of the Sea, Why Bother to Garden? It's a great question as far as I'm concerned. I quote Garfield in my little introduction to the paper. He said, they say to him, what do you think of the great outdoors, Garfield? And he goes, the one thing I would do to improve the great outdoors is put a roof over it. I'm a little bit of Garfield. And next week, though, we're not going to be talking about cats, Thea.
No.
We're going to be talking about dogs.
Yes.
So maybe we can talk about Alf?
Maybe I'll bring Alf in.
Oh, that'd be lovely. You won't do it, though. That'd be brilliant. The cover of the TLS next week is a lovely picture of a
photo of Alf. Is it not? Oh.
No. We'll talk about that off air. You don't want to miss that. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.